You've already done so much. You don't have enough batter for me? I asked. It's not that. It's just that I bet your parents are waiting for you. I'm getting in the way. No. A muscle in his jaw clenched. Look, we'd love to have you stay, but I met his bluff. I lined up 4 perfect glasses on the counter, opened the milk carton, and filled all 4. I lifted a stack of plates from the cabinet and carried them to the table. As I did, the cats arrived from nowhere and bore down on my ankles with the sides of their faces. Steam from Leo's skillet fogged up all the windows. I could no longer see out. Goodbye, woods, I thought. Goodbye, world. The pancakes were sizzling, and the cats were meowing, and the water was boiling rapidly around the glass syrup bottle. Classical music webbed back and forth through the air. I laid out knives and forks, paper napkins, a plate of sliced butter. When Leo's back was turned, Patra leaned into Paul's room, holding on to the molding with her hands. Then she pulled her head out, padded around the living room on bare feet, straightened pillows, restacked books, folded a blanket. Abruptly, she turned to Leo and me in the kitchen. What a good idea. Right? Breakfast. And Linda's here, she added, coming over and giving me a hug, pushing herself in so I could feel her pointy chin tucked over my shoulder. Little Patra, shorter by an inch than I was, all limbs, all cool and clammy skin in her t-shirt. Then, fast as that, she moved away, kissed Leo on the back of the neck. Leo the larger, she said on tiptoe, and I could see that some energy she could barely contain was coursing through her. All her movements had a jerky, outsized exuberance, as if she were struggling to contain something inside herself. She hastily rinsed the spatula Leo had used for mixing. She washed the mixing bowl, swiped at the counter with a paper towel, and at some point she lifted an egg absent-mindedly from the carton and squeezed it until it cracked open. What am I doing? She asked, holding up her glistening, gooey hand. But she seemed to be laughing. What a mess! She exclaimed, rubbing her hand with a dish towel, vigorously wiping each of her fingers. Then she took a deep, steadying breath and sat down at the table. Okay, I'm starving, she said. Where are those pancakes? I brought Patra her glass of milk, and while Leo went to get Paul, piled pancakes onto our plates. Leo returned only seconds later, smiling directly at Patra, smiling so wide that her lips curled up too, slightly, and said, "The little king wants his in bed." So he turned to leave again, with a plate and glass of milk. Halfway across the room, his head swiveled around. "I got it, Patty. Eat." I watched her sit back down. Without speaking, she broke off a piece of pancake with her fingers and put it in her mouth. I did the same. I was so hungry, and the pancakes were so warm and soft, still gooey with batter in the middle. You could eat them without chewing much. You could get a lot into your mouth at once. You could nearly drink those pancakes down. I kept breaking off and pushing pieces in my mouth, and just when I thought I'd never get enough, never be filled up, I looked over and saw that Patra had stopped eating. Her lips were partway open, and I could see the half-chewed pancake wedged between her teeth and gums, balanced in a frothy mix on her lower lip. She sat there with her cheeks bulged out for 10 seconds, 20, and then, at last, she deliberately closed her eyes, carefully rotated her jaw, and forced that huge pancake wad down her throat. I saw it go. Patra? I said, a low rumble of fear moving through me. What was Paul like at that point? I was asked later. I remember wondering if Patra would choke. I wondered if a person's windpipe could be blocked by something as harmless and soft as pancake. If that kind of crisis was possible. Ugh. Patra murmured. Then she stood up and went straight to the couch. She pulled her scrawny knees up inside her t-shirt, lay her head on a cushion. That's enough of that, she whispered. What time was it then? It was either very early or very late, and as I looked across the table at the crumbs we'd made, at the pile of pancakes left, I felt suddenly drained. I made a ball of my napkin, drank the last gulp of milk from my glass. Then I went around the room, flicking off the lights Leo had turned on. I found the blanket Patra had folded minutes before, shook it open over her curled form, and sat down at the other end of the couch. Leo's music played on. I didn't say anything to Patra. We looked out the window together. My parents' cabin across the lake was dark now, but the night sky was still bright. Perhaps, I thought, a full moon had risen, or perhaps true dawn had come at last. On the shore, my dad's Winona gleamed like a beached fish. "You saw me coming?" I asked. I wanted to hear that story again. "Oh, Linda. Have you ever been in a canoe?" "Once, but I'm not like you. I'm a city kid, you know." "I know." She glanced at me across the couch. "At camp. They plopped me down in a canoe, and all I could think was, I'm going to fall out. And the more I thought that, the more I was afraid I'd eventually tip the thing just because I'd imagined it so clearly. Splash." "Everybody thinks that." She exhaled slowly. "I need to get better at controlling my thoughts." "Everyone eventually tips." "Do they? Leo never thinks like that." "Like what?" "Like the worst thing, the very worst thing could happen." I didn't say anything. "He's a good dad." "Yeah? And Paul, my Paul, is such a good kid." "He is." She seemed pleased to hear me say that. She lifted the blanket for me to come under. So I moved in closer and let her cover me up. "You know how Paul was born?" she asked, tucking the blanket around my legs. "No, I hadn't thought about that. I'd only ever thought of Paul as fully formed, as a 4-year-old arrival from another planet. I never thought of him as an infant, as one of those hours-old, red and wet mounds of flesh, as coming out of Patra. Let me tell you something, Linda." And I wanted her to tell me something. I did. "After I got pregnant with Paul, I was sick for so long. I had this belief I was doomed somehow, that everything that could go wrong would. I had such a bad feeling about it. Leo kept saying, 'You're afraid, that's all it is, you're afraid.' And I was. I was so worried. I'd made a huge mistake." "You'd just finished college?" "My friends were joining the Peace Corps, starting grad school." "It makes sense, how you felt." "It wasn't just that I was afraid. It felt really real how sick I was during pregnancy. There were all these complications. Leo kept urging me to worry less, kept reading me all his books. But it was one thing after another, low fetal weight, premature contractions, everything you could think of. Then, during labor, I actually felt my heart stop. I actually heard it go thump, thump, thump." She patted my leg as she said this. "Then nothing else. And that's when I had this tiny thought that I'd been wrong to be so scared of this, that God wouldn't do that. God wouldn't just stop my heart, would he?" My throat closed up at the idea. "He wouldn't." Later, Leo said, "That thought about God was Paul. That thought was him being born." Through the window, The black trees stood stiff and unyielding. Patra was quiet, her hand on my leg. She was quiet for such a long time I thought she'd drifted off, but then I felt her shift position, move closer to me so our heads almost touched on the couch cushions. She was whispering. I'd been resisting Leo's way of thinking for such a long time. I kept telling him, I just don't have your kind of mind that believes one thing without question. But then, Paul was there, and everything was fine. Paul was perfect, truly. And I was so happy after that, not fighting Leo anymore. Going his way seemed easy. There's nothing to say about happiness, you know. Nobody believes you when you talk about it. She was crying now. She was asking me, I'm so happy. Right? Don't we seem happy to you? You do, I assured her. You are. I must have dozed off, because the next thing I knew, I was half under the blanket and half under Patra's legs. I could barely move beneath her soft, warm weight. I could see Patra's head sticking out from the other side of the blanket, and I felt a deep, body gladness suddenly, the same as when I used to curl up with Tamika in a sleeping bag in our shared bed. That old feeling came back to me hard, the way the sleeping bag had been like a second body we'd put on each night, the best body of all, so much more substantial than our separate ones. I nestled closer to Patra, let my hip sink into a crack in the cushions, closed my eyes. Perhaps something did tug at the edge of my consciousness then, because I remember thinking there was nothing to be worried about. That worrying now was like worrying the canoe would tip because you'd imagined it would happen. That was impossible, I told myself. It didn't work like that. When I awoke next, I was sweating. Leo's CD was no longer playing, and a breeze was moving through my hair. I pushed a corner of the blanket back and let my damp neck grow chill in the cool air. What time was it? Patra, across the couch, was sleeping soundly. Somehow I stood without waking her, and it was only when I took a few steps that I realized the breeze I felt came from outside. I smelled a bit of woods blow in, the bright scent of pine needles. The sliding door to the deck was wide open and a litter of pale leaves lay across the rug. I stepped, shivering across the threshold. True night had come at last, the sky starless, dark, empty. Someone was at the telescope, crouched. Paul? He looked up at me, and his face was bright and clear as anything. He looked stronger and healthier than I'd seen him in days, the whites of his eyes and the whites of his teeth flashing, even in the dark. His hair had been worked by a finger into a sharp spoke that stood on the very top of his head. He was smiling. Oh, brother, another beaver. He giggled. Paul. I felt relief then. I felt relief enough to scold him. Come on inside. Let's play survival together, he suggested. Not now. Look, here comes a bear. He started running. He took off down the stairs and into the woods. For such a little kid, he moved far faster than I thought he could, scrambling over logs and under branches, pushing through pine boughs, so they whipped back against my chest. I was running after him in my socks. Paul was in his footed pajamas. I could barely keep up, though the wet leaves and mossy rocks were all familiar to me. Then, the last branch fell away, and the trees opened up, and the shore was in front of us. I saw, to my shock, that a silvery crust of early ice had congealed over the water. Paul looked back at me once, his hair horn bent double. He yelled, "Oh, no! A bear!" The next thing I knew, he was down on his belly, elbowing his way onto that thin sheet of ice. And I realized at last how cold it was, how the smell of snow thinned the air in my nostrils, how my fingertips were already going a little numb. "Paul!" I called out, taking a small step onto the ice, listening to it splinter under my weight, feeling the whole thing give way. My third step broke through to my ankles. As I stood in the bitter cold water, as I watched Paul drag himself across the ice by the elbows, pulling himself, snake-like, toward the center of the lake, it came to me, finally, that this was a dream. Then it was dawn. Two gray triangles of sky shone through the big windows. Mist was rising off the lake, and I could just make out my parents' cabin through the haze. Bit by bit, I took in the shadowy room around me. Paul's light was off, Leo was snoring somewhere out of sight, and Patra was beside me on the couch, still sleeping. The sliding glass door was shut tight. Everything was in its rightful place. I sat up more fully and saw Drake pacing back and forth, in front of Paul's closed door. From the corner of my eye, I spotted Leo's manuscript on the easy chair. Unwilling to go back to sleep, but also unwilling to leave the couch, I leaned over and lifted the top page from the thick stack of papers. I was expecting a document about space, something about the misguided search for extraterrestrial life based on unexamined assumptions. I thought I had a feel for the way Leo would write. I expected jargon and equations mixed with deceptively simple questions. I hoped for diagrams. Instead, the page on top was written in bland, square language. Once I had it in my hands, I noticed it used a different font than the manuscript beneath. I read the page twice through, first focusing on the typewritten words, and then on Patra's edits in purple pen. She crossed out a few phrases and scrawled a note in skinny cursive at the bottom. Here's what Leo wrote. "Let me start by acknowledging the goodness that is the Church of Christ Scientist and the inspired teachings of Mary Baker Eddy. Today, I want to give thanks for the omnipotent grace of God, who shows himself to be the childlike nature in us all. My son, who has recently struggled with the belief of a stomach ache, surprised me one night by asking me to read the Scientific Statement of Being instead of his favorite bedtime story. He is 4 years old, but his wisdom has long been a model to his mother and me. I read him the statement we all know so well. There is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. After I finished, he asked me, 'What is matter?' I was taken aback because he'd never asked this before. As a scientist, I thought of all the definitions my colleagues discuss. But as a scientist, I was led to tell him, 'Your stomach ache and everything else that lies to you and tries to pretend it is real.' He said to me then, 'I'm not matter. I don't lie.' So I saw that he knew better than I, his own spiritual nature. By the morning after our conversation, my son's stomach ache was entirely gone, and he was able to prepare for a weekend trip we'd planned as a family. His demonstration was complete. As Mary Baker Eddy says, become conscious for a single moment that life and intelligence are purely spiritual, neither in nor of matter, and the body will then utter no complaints. I'm so continually grateful to this church, which has sustained me and my family with the true teachings of Christ all these years." Here's what Patra had added at the bottom. "Maybe start with a little more description of Paul. Maybe add a little more about what he was struggling with. Didn't he say, 'I don't matter,' instead of, 'I'm not matter?' Remember how he spooked me with that, and how you corrected him, and it was funny and sweet and everybody laughed? Remember how he was sitting with that old glove of yours pulled up to his elbow, and he kept petting your chin as you talked to him? Details like those that will move people, I think. Don't forget to put a few details like that in. Or remember how he was trying to fit both hands in that glove at once like a fin? That was funny, too. Remember how when he took his hands out, all those little rocks from the lake came out on your lap? I'm not sure how that fits, but otherwise, of course, this is very beautiful. Chapter 14. I wrote Mr. Grierson a letter once. He was living in Florida when I tracked him down, in a little town outside Tallahassee called Crawfordville, which was named for a doctor who'd lived there long ago. That's what the internet said. I learned from online reports that Mr. Grierson kept a shop, a place that sold Star Wars lunchboxes and 19th-century rocking chairs and 1950s postcards of orange groves. The postcard oranges were shiny, balloon yellow. Not really orange at all. Junk, people called it. The treasure chest, the shop was called. "Dear Mr. Grierson," I wrote. Then I stopped. I was living in Minneapolis by then. I was eating my dinners with the mechanic and working days as an office temp, and when I couldn't sleep at night, I read biographies of explorers, stories about the sick drive to Everest where men with frostbitten fingers dug in the ice with spoons. I read these books with a flashlight so as not to awaken Anne in her single bed across the room. I read for hours, in a shadowy cave of blankets, leaning against the cold wall, growing impatient with the hopelessly boyish ploys for survival. When the climbers inevitably started up the mountain in a storm with just a pocket knife and a shovel, I tried writing Mr. Grierson instead. I started the same letter again and again. Dawn grayed and regrayed the room. "Dear Mr. Grierson," I wrote. "Dear Adam. To Adam Grierson. To Mr. Adam Grierson. Dear you." Then, finally, "You may not remember me. I was your student in 8th grade, American history, in Loose River, Minnesota. I was the one by the window in the lumberjack shirt, and the long braid, and the hiking boots. You knew me as Maddie. You called me Miss Originality, for the prize I won in History Odyssey. I did wolves, remember? I did a history of wolves. I'm writing now because I've been thinking about something that has bothered me for a while. After you left Loose River and after Lily Holborn said the things she did, no one ever spoke one word about what you taught us in class. It was weird to me, like all those days never happened. But I guess you put a lot of energy into your lessons. I remember how you stood up and recited the whole Declaration of Independence by heart, which must have been a lot of work to memorize. I remember how you had us draw maps of the country as if we were Lewis and Clark, as if we only knew the shapes of the rivers by riding them. When you took me to History Odyssey, I admit I thought you were laughing at my wolf idea. But later I thought about how you picked me to do it over everybody else. Maybe you saw me as less trouble for you than some other girl, but it seems to me now that the reasons you picked me matter less than the fact of it. Did you know that when Lily Holborn came back to school the fall after you left, she had a surprise for us? People had been saying for a while she was sick, but no, she was pregnant, which sealed her fate and yours in town, though most people had heard by then that she'd taken back her testimony against you. The courtroom, people said, had spooked her. Can you imagine Lily pregnant? She was very beautiful, actually. She was even more beautiful than she was before. But then she got on a bus one day and went to St. Paul, where there was a program for girls like her associated with the Catholic Church. She became a blood lab technician, I heard. The program gave her free career training, baby clothes and stuff, so it's not hard now to guess why she lied about you. Lots of animals in a trap will play dead. That's how I think of what she did. She found a sneaky way out of the little life she would have had if they'd made her stay and get married to the guy who knocked her up. Lily wasn't as dumb as she looked. But probably you knew that already. I thought once about moving to California. That's where you're from, right? I wanted to see the redwoods there. I wanted to feel miniature beside those big trees, to alter for good my sense of the scale of things. I've heard people say those trees can do that to you. But Minneapolis is more affordable. The trees here are a lot like the trees in Loose River, though there are fewer of them. I've never been to Florida, either. I think if I came into your shop, I would buy the rocking chair with the high back and the bent oak runners. It looks comfortable in the picture on your website. It doesn't seem like junk. I've read what people say about you online, about how you shouldn't get to live in their town. What if a kid wanders into your store, and so on? Maybe they have good reasons to write what they do, but I think you should hear this, too. I think you're innocent. I think you should hear that from someone. I think someone should say that to you, and in case no one has, I'm that someone for you. Sincerely, Maddie Furston. Dawn is a free pass. I've always thought that. The hours between 4 and 7 belong to a few fidgety birds and maybe a last bat charging mosquitoes. In Minneapolis, the traffic from the highway would grow louder and louder, and eventually a slant of light would work its way in through the curtain and crawl up my neck. That's when I put away my books and papers. At 7 on the dot, I got out of bed, boiled water on the stove, and strained coffee for me and Anne. I wiggled into my pantyhose in the bathroom. When I stuck out my tongue to brush it, the girl in the mirror was gagging at me, earnestly, eyes red. That morning, in the gardener cabin, 7 o'clock came and went without anyone stirring at all. This was a surprise to me, I guess, but only because I'd assumed the gardeners were early risers. From my place on the couch beside Patra, I watched the lake silver gradually, and then I watched it net the first few bits of new sun. A loon surfaced on the far side and looked around. A motorboat sped past grumpily, calving the water, and when another boat followed in its wake, I remember wanting the morning to slow down, slow down. I wanted the morning to hold still, to take its time in coming. Patra woke up reluctantly. She kept opening her eyes partway and closing them again, as if reassured by my presence, as if my presence gave her permission to return to unconsciousness without guilt. When the early light caught her face, every freckle became vivid and precise. I watched two of them quiver together over her right eyelid. I noticed a slim white scar I'd never seen before, parting the down on her upper lip. I saw tiny flecks of dandruff riding a few hairs near her scalp. Later, it would be impossible for me to tell anyone of the happiness of those hours, the exquisite sweetness of sitting there with her asleep beside me on the couch, and it was very hard for me to admit even to myself how much of that feeling had to do with Paul and Leo being safely out of the room. A slice of sunlight edged up her blanketed thigh. I remember how her breathing moved the natty yellow cotton up and down, how her eyeballs beneath the freckled lids shifted in her sleep. I noticed the palest blue vein in her neck. I didn't touch her. I sat cross-legged on the couch, the blanket covering us both, one of her small red knees poking out from a corner. At the time, I did not question why she'd stayed with me in the living room, and not with Leo in their bed or with Paul in his room. I did not wonder why she chose to stay asleep so long, which seemed natural to me at the time, proof that everything was fine. That she was there with me after all those hours, that she was calmly sleeping still, was the only reassurance in the world I needed. Later, of course, I would wonder about it. Later, when I was asked about her actions, I wouldn't have a very good answer for why she hadn't gone in to check on Paul that night. The suggestion at the trial was that she'd remained with me in outright denial of the facts, that she'd aligned herself with a 15-year-old because she wanted to feel less responsible herself. A more generous interpretation was that she identified with me because we were both susceptible, in a sense. Young girls under the influence of a dogmatic older man. Leo, it was said, had kept Paul away from her on purpose. There's some truth to both theories advanced at the trial. I saw evidence for each. But even at the time I understood that they had missed something. They'd left something out. They didn't account for Patra's awareness of her own power, her disorganized but formidable determination. They didn't account for what made Patra, Patra. Didn't she always need someone to watch her and approve? And wasn't I better at that than anyone? When at last she woke for good, when she sat up on the couch and pulled the blanket over her knees, she had a closed-lipped smile waiting for me, like a reward for my vigil. "So," she said, "Janet stayed all night." "Janet?" Rochester's name for Jane Eyre. She was a governess, too, like you. She brushed some hair out of her face. "You're both governesses." She smiled at the word. Then, as if catching herself, "What time is it?" I shrugged. She sat up straighter. "Where's Leo?" I shrugged again. She turned and shot a wild look down the hall. But instead of standing, as I thought she would, she closed her eyes. She appeared to be fighting something, summoning stillness through strength of will. Then she let out a deep breath through her white teeth, and I could smell it a foot away, the rot and decay, the remains of an undigested meal. She opened her eyes again, squinting a little. "Did you read that?" She was looking at Leo's typed page on the chair beside me. I waited a second before answering. "Yeah? It's okay." She leaned forward in a gargoyle-like crouch, set a damp palm on my arm. "It's okay, you know," she said, breathing it out as if she were talking herself towards something. Her fetid breath and her hand on my arm made something squirrel through my gut. I leaned closer to smell her breath again, disgusted with myself. Disgusted and interested, both. When she spoke again, her voice was lower than usual. "I keep telling myself worry is the problem. That's the thing to work on, right?" I hesitated. "I don't know. It's a problem with my mind." "Well," I thought about it. Something snagged. "What do you mean?" "What do I mean?" She looked raked clean, purged for some reason by the question. She stuck out her tongue, laughing. And I could see it with its layer of white scum slide back over her teeth. Between last night and now, there was something looser about her, more disjointed, more tantalizing. She swallowed, grabbed my hand in hers. Her eyes were bouncing from thing to thing. "You're right, Linda. Of course you're right. It's stupid to worry about worry. Look, Drake's back, and Leo's here, and you're here, too. Everything's good." "I'm here, too. Everything's fine. Everything is," I nodded. "I know, I know. Not even a cloud in the sky. And those are birds singing, right? Chickadees. See, you know. I knew you'd know." And because it seemed so easy to make her happy now, I added, "And purple martins." "Purple martins, okay. And," I listened, "two loons." Though that was a whine of a motor, possibly. Maybe I was making things up, exaggerating slightly. "Two loons, of course. I should know that. I should know. The thing is to let myself take things as they really are, like this." In a flash, I saw the white field of ice that was the lake last night. "We just need to know the truth," she said. Here was the truth. Everyone else was still sleeping. Everyone but us. I nodded. Hey, you're wearing my headband, she said. Her eyes stopped on my face. I acknowledged, relishing the feel of her gaze. The old ache was still there, but it had changed. It had become part of my head. It had both affixed itself to me and disappeared. Looks good on you, she said. Then Patra's phone rang. Star Wars did 3 notes before Leo appeared from the back room, instantly like a grouse flushed from the bushes. Patra seized the phone and jumped up to get closer to the deck, saying, Hello? And thank you, yes. I stood up too, holding onto the blanket that was still warm from our bodies. I kept my eye on Leo in the doorway, but he never once glanced in my direction. He was watching Patra, who was agreeing enthusiastically with the person on the phone as she paced up and down, nodding continuously. Good, good, good. She paused mid-step to take something in. I'm trying to do that. I'm really, really trying. I am, she brightened. I'm feeling so much better now it's morning. It's a turning point, maybe. Yes, he is perfect in God's eyes. That's what I've been thinking. And guess what? I didn't even tell you the most important part. She started pacing again, heading toward the table. He had breakfast. What, pancakes? What was that? So sorry about the connection, but absolutely, yes, that's true. Yes, we are. We are so grateful. When she got off the phone, she turned to Leo with a huge, haphazard grin on her face, which gradually closed down as she stood there. One look at Leo, and that smile went out of business. Did they ever, to your knowledge, call a doctor? I was asked. Patra said, That was the practitioner, Mrs. Julian? Yes, Leo confirmed. Though it had been Patra, of course, not him who spoke to her. She said we should be grateful. We are, he told her. There was a new stillness to him this morning, an economy of gesture, as if he'd realized how little movement was required to sustain himself. I watched him assemble some kind of smile on his face. There went his lips, pointing up. To Patra, he said, How about some hot cocoa? Can you put on the kettle, P? She shook her head once, and something strange was happening as she walked across the room toward him. All the braided rugs were sliding, then colliding under her feet. She was walking that fast. He stopped her by opening up his arms and giving her a hug. As he held on to her, his voice changed. It grew musical, full of highs and lows. What are you doing, Patty P? Let's not backtrack now, Patty Cakes. Let's do what we always do. Make the cocoa, clean the litter box, go about the morning. Can you do that for me? I watched him put his mouth against her ear. Then, over her head and without the singing, Linda, will you help me with something? I'd assumed he was ignoring me, so his question took me off guard. I frowned at him and prepared to shake my head. I felt my shoulders lift up defensively, but when he let go of Patra and turned, I found myself following him out. I was curious. I couldn't help it. Patra, he said, when she started after us, some cocoa. Then the litter box. Get dressed. Maybe read the lesson. It really is a beautiful day. In my dream, Paul had been so wily and quick. He'd seemed both mischievous and manic, which had amused and irritated me in turns. In my dream, I'd become furious with him at last. There had been something very devious about the way he'd wiggled across the ice on his belly. So, when I followed Leo into Paul's room, I felt some residue of resentment waiting for him. I took one look at him lying in bed and felt my resentment go dry. He was only a kid, after all. A little kid sleeping. It was relieving to see him flat on his stomach, to see him tucked to his neck and covers, his golden head poking out. His chapped lips were open, his eyes closed. "Now, Linda, don't be afraid," Leo murmured from behind, and it wasn't until he said it that I was. "Now, Linda, it's okay." He seemed to want to pat my shoulder. Leo closed the door behind us, and my first thought was to back away. My second thought was to look for a way out. I wasn't sure what trap I'd been led into. I felt my calves tense up, my fingertips tingle. Leo's face looked lopsided. He was pushing out one cheek with the tip of his tongue, and I knew without thinking it through that this was something he only did when alone. "We're playing Candyland," he told me, almost bashfully, gesturing toward the floor. "What?" But it was clear enough. The pastel board was spread out over the carpet, a path of colored squares snaking across. "Paul's blue, I'm red." "Okay." But Paul was asleep. "Just move his piece when it's his turn," Leo nodded at me encouragingly. "I've got to use the bathroom, quick, and make one little call. If you could let me know if he..." He was painfully apologetic about it. He was stacking a Bible and some other books on Paul's nightstand in a low, embarrassed tower. He was glancing at the full plate of pancakes on the dresser, hastily and without turning his head, as if he didn't want me to notice it, but couldn't keep from looking himself. Then he just stood there, eyes bloodshot, tongue tenting one cheek. "Leo?" I asked him. He started tucking in his shirt with his fingertips. "Don't be afraid," I found myself saying. Leo tucked in his shirt again, and again he pushed the fabric down deep. He hitched up his shorts and shoved in his shirt. The fabric strained against his shoulders, and he looked like he wanted to tuck in his whole torso and his arms up to the elbows. He was going to tuck his whole self in. To stop him, I knelt on the carpeted floor next to the Candyland board. "Paul," I said to get Leo to leave, "it's your turn." Actually, I didn't know how to play Candyland. I'd never played games like this when I was a kid, so the rules, the way to move from square to square, eluded me. There were no dice or one of those arrows you spin. I could sense Paul in his lump of covers on the bed, but I didn't try to wake him. Without thinking, I pulled a card from the stack. I moved Paul's blue gingerbread man toward the yellow square the card matched, then Leo's red man, blue then red. With a sinking heart, it came to me that I didn't need to know how to play. It was obvious. It was a race. Gingerbread Leo plodded past the crooked old peanut brittle house. Gingerbread Paul took a shortcut through the gumdrop mountains. After only a few turns, I felt the deep drudgery of having played this game too many times before. I slid the pieces steadily along the pastel track. Leo wound through the lollipop woods, and Paul got stuck on a licorice space. Just when Leo's man was closing in on the molasses swamp, just when the outcome started to seem inevitable, though still a long way off, I happened to look up. "Paul?" He was watching me from his bed. His breathing deepened, then paused. Half his face was smashed against the pillow, but one eye looked out, unblinking, blue as anything. "Paul?" I asked. His pillowcase darkened with spittle as he started breathing again. I cheated then. I set Gingerbread Paul on the final space. The eye tracked over my shoulder and past my head. I scrambled to my feet. In the hallway, I ran into Leo, whose hands were dripping from the bathroom. "Hmm?" he asked, still buckling his belt, leaving huge wet handprints on his blue cotton shirt. I didn't know what to say. "He won," is what came out, and I felt my voice hack through a crust of panic to say it. "He did." Leo looked truly relieved to hear me say it, as if winning Candyland were an achievement, as if watching someone else move your piece around a board counted now as victory. That's a lucky break. He's got to be happy about that. He's got to be. He'll be back to his old self before we know it. It won't take much. He'll be ready for kindergarten in a few weeks. He's only 4. It felt like a protest to put it like that. Leo took that in, then rejected it. But he's got his head on straight. You know him. He's very, very advanced for his age. He'll be fine. He's going to be fine. I shook my head. He's still so defenseless, I meant. Such a little kid. I tried to corral some evidence to back me up. He doesn't even know how to read. Something about that, the fact that Paul couldn't even sound out train in his very favorite book, made tears spring to my eyes. Leo didn't seem to see them. He put his wet hands on his hips, settled into the argument. He looked more comfortable now, back in terrain where he knew he could triumph. Well, now, that's not strictly true, Linda. You know that. He can read a little. He can read Paul. And no, he's memorized those words. I was veering far past the point. Well, I'm not sure that's fair. What do you do when you read? Do you sound it out? What? I shook my head, bewildered. Listen, Leo. Now, Linda. He reached out and cupped my hands in his wet palms. He was pressing them now, squeezing my fingers. His voice grew musical the way it had with Patra. He'd gotten my hands wet, like his. He insisted, "You've been an enormous help. Now, I'm just gonna pop back in, see what he might be up for next. Excuse me a moment, all right?" I left Leo and went into the main room where the dishes from breakfast were still on the table. Drops of maple syrup had congealed to amber beads on the plates. Pancake crumbs were scattered in wide constellations across the wood table, the bamboo placemats, the maple floorboards. Patra, still in her T-shirt, was cleaning the litter box. She was on her knees in the kitchen, with a blue plastic shovel in one hand and a white garbage bag in the other. She looked like a little kid playing in the sand. She glanced up at me, pushing hair from her eyes as I came around the kitchen island. There must have been something in my face she didn't like, because she took one look at me and started scooting back on her knees across the tile. "Patra," I said, coming forward. She stood up, kitty litter embedded in her knees, pressed into her red skin in a gray mosaic. I took a step toward her, but she put the island between us. She held on to the white laminate counter. I came around the island toward her, and she circled the same direction, moving away from me. "Patra," I said again. "It's okay," she asked, pleading, as if I could do that for her, as if I could spare her. "I think maybe, he needs something, like from the drugstore, or..." "Don't tell Leo," she interrupted. I retreated from what I might have said, like Tylenol or something. "Leo says, control your thoughts, think of Paul as a new day. I can go to the drugstore for you, okay? And who can stop a new day from coming? I should go get something, I think." I licked my dry lips. "Patra! Patra!" I'd been creeping faster than she was moving away the whole time. Now I was just inches from her. There she stood, with her reeking morning breath and kitty litter knees. I could tell by the look in her eye that she was riding just the surface of her brain, bobbing on that choppy surface of hope and worry. So, on impulse, I kissed her on the lips, hating her purely in that instant, wanting to do more than that, to hurt her, to slap her, to get something back. Her lips were cool and flat, unresponsive. It didn't seem like lips. "Just the Tylenol," she said, stepping sideways, not really taking me in, not really a mind at all, just a bobbing boat on a wave. "This is fucked," I said softly. "What?" she said. She was too miserable to hurt, though. Her T-shirt barely covered her panties. She was every bit of her limbs, gangly and thin, almost naked. The scar on her lip seemed to pulse red, then white. I was that close. I was close enough to see that. Fine, then, I told her. I walked across the room and worked my socked feet into my tennis shoes on the skewed welcome mat. Then I spun the handle on the front door, opening it up to the harsh, bright rectangle of summer. Looked back once at Patra, in her wrinkled t-shirt by the counter. She was soundlessly twisting her lips, slowly, weirdly mouthing, "Thank you," in a way that made me want to turn back and force her to speak out loud. But then, I was gone. Outside on the driveway, it was hot already. I took a few steps into the woods, as if on my way home, and then abruptly squatted down and lifted the granite stone on the edge of the trail. Worms waved blindly up. Tiny, translucent beetles moved in stupid circles. Everything was squirming and pulsing piteously, but there were the bills Patra had left weeks ago. They were sodden and damp, but they were real money. I stuffed them in my pocket and took off at a sprint. Chapter 15. For 3 years after high school, I took classes at Itasca Community College in Grand Rapids. I worked at a pizzeria bar called The Binge that had brown vinyl booths and wine bottle vases plugged with plastic carnations. The only requirements for the job were to wear black shorts, even in winter, and to keep the salad bar stocked with chopped lettuce and shaved carrots. During that time, I saved money for a down payment on an 88 Chevy Corsica, and in the years after I bought that car, I lived in Duluth, where I worked retail and cleaned houses on the side. Sometimes on my days off, I'd walk down to the water and wait for the lift bridge to go up, for ore ships and sailboats to slink out of the harbor. I didn't stand on the grassy knoll with tourists, but crossed the bridge and sat in stiff Weymouth sand. The fourth spring I was there, my dad died. After the funeral in Loose River, after I crashed my Corsica in the trees and sold the car for parts, I found a job at a temp service in the cities. The temp service placed me at Manico Barge, where I answered calls from hoarse-voiced men hauling scrap steel and corn down the Mississippi. My job was to arrange their schedules, give the anticipated arrival and departure times of their trips, sometimes take calls from their wives and make their excuses. I ate packed lunches in the break room with the other temps, and at the end of each day I walked to the bus stop downtown on salt-strewn streets. Through the scratched windows of the bus, I watched snow fall in fat orbs under lights, all across the river. The mechanic's apartment was a basement walkout in a once grand Victorian. Students lived in the turrets. Bare poplar seedlings sprouted in all the gutters. "Hey there," I'd say to Rom when he opened his rickety back door. Still in his mechanic's clothes, still in his greasy blue coveralls, his blue eyes watering at the cold I let in. I'd hold up a frozen pizza and a six-pack of Buds. "Oh, man," he'd say. "Oh, really, a tombstone? You shouldn't have." If he was unimpressed, it didn't stop him from drinking his three beers in the 30 minutes it took for the oven to heat up and cook the pizza. I kept him from my beers by whacking his hand every time he reached for one more. "Fair's fair," I'd say. So, one night, Rom went into the bedroom and brought back a fifth of whiskey. As he swigged from his bottle, he whipped up his standard salad from bulgur, mint, and a cucumber. He made me drink a glass of milk as we waited for the pizza to cook. He made me eat a few bites of the salad and half an orange before allowing me one little sip of his ratty booze. "Fair's fair," he mocked. The pizza cheese burned the roofs of our mouths. When I went for another swig of whiskey, he pulled the bottle out of reach. "Eat your salad," he commanded. That first winter I was in the cities, Rom was big on vitamins. He thought I ate like shit and had an unresolved past and should go to the dentist. He wanted us to eat at his table, so he set out plates and squares of paper towels folded in half. He'd started pressing for a pet, a Labrador retriever, because he thought a dog would lead to a more regular schedule. A shared apartment, more exercise, weekend trips to the North Shore, a fucking campfire, I don't know what. When I rolled my eyes at all that, he said, "If you're not going anywhere, Girl Scout, just shut up, okay? Just shut up." I didn't say anything, I protested. You didn't have to. Sometimes after supper, we put on our mittens and hats and walked to the movie theater a few blocks down toward the Capitol. We split the cost for two seats, two Cokes, and a bucket of popcorn. The movie's rom-chos were always unrelentingly loud, full of cops shooting over the hoods of cars. Still, I found it restful to sit there in the pulsing dark. The louder it was, the sooner I slept, my head against the seat back, my shoes sticking to the floor. I didn't mind missing the car chases, the explosions. It was reassuring to feel that something important just went on happening while I slept, something with guns. Afterward, Rom would test me to see when I'd fallen asleep. "That guy with the face that turned into a fish," he'd say when we were walking out. "Did you see that?" And I'd say, though I usually hadn't, "He was incredible." When I'd been in the cities for about 8 months, when the holidays rolled around, I showed up at Rom's apartment on Christmas Eve carrying a little package I'd wrapped in red reindeer paper and a thin green bow. Rom opened it on his unmade bed sitting cross-legged. His feet were bare, yellow-nailed, but he was wearing stiff new jeans and a black button-up shirt, untucked. I watched as he broke the green ribbon with his teeth and lifted from the box a dog's spiky collar and heavy leather lead. It took a moment for him to unwind the leash, and it's weird how joy goes through a grown man's face, so that for a second you can see him the way he was as a kid, all smooth-faced and unguarded. Then that look was gone, and he was squinting at me as I wiggled out of my jeans, as I unhooked my bra and got completely naked. I took the leather collar and fastened it around my neck. For an instant, he looked so disheartened, so disappointed, like I'd done the one thing that could truly hurt him. But then I sniffed his crotch and handed him the leash. So we had a good time. "Bad girl," he told me. I pulled against the leash. I wouldn't go where he said. "Down," he warned, a glint in his eyes. "Stay." His present for me was a Swiss Army knife. "Fool's protection," he explained, looking a little nervous, leaning in so I could hear the stud in his tongue click against his teeth. This was after we'd gotten dressed again and were sipping eggnog in his bed straight from the carton. He waited until I said, "Cool, thank you," before showing me all the things the knife could do, peel an orange, scale a fish. I didn't tell him I had the exact same knife in my purse, though more banged up. I didn't tell him I already knew which metal slit to pull with my fingernail to get the wire stripper out, or the 3-inch blade. It was like so many other things between us, that gift. It was exactly right and totally wrong for me. That same winter, just after Christmas, I received a bright red envelope in the mail. Anne and I were sorting bills on a dark afternoon, when she held up the envelope with a Santa stamp, a Florida return address. "Is this from your family?" she asked. I took it from her, her pale, plucked eyebrows arched hopefully over the rims of her glasses. It bothered Anne. It broke her strict code of Canadian niceness that I hadn't any formal holiday plans, that I wouldn't tell her even the littlest thing about where I'd come from. I hesitated long enough to flip the envelope chestward before saying, "Yep." I stood and carried the envelope to our kitchenette. Inside was a holiday card with reindeer and ho-ho-hos in black cursive. When I opened the card, out winged a photograph of a white-haired man with his arm slung around a dog. It was creepy, in a way, but also not. It was just a guy in a lawn chair, a guy with his hound, a palm tree shadow floating over his head. I could feel Anne watching from across the room. "Where in Florida does your family live?" she asked. I couldn't look at her to answer. I couldn't bear to talk about Loose River, so I headed toward the doorway instead.